Hey, listeners. Welcome to the Learn to Code with Me podcast. I'm your host, Laurence Bradford. Before we get into today's episode, I just wanted to remind you that you can get the show notes for this episode and every other episode at learntocodewith.me/podcast. And if you enjoy the show, make sure to subscribe on whichever podcast player you listen on. And if you're feeling particularly generous, a review would be awesome too. Here's a quick word from our sponsors who help make the show possible. The Product College is an accelerated higher education for the next generation of tech leaders. Only pay tuition after you graduate and launch your career at companies like Facebook and Google. Find out more at makeschool.com. That's makeschool.com. Flatiron School's online web developer program focuses on community, actual development tools, and features a curriculum that will teach you the skills you need to land a career as a software engineer. Get $500 off your first month by visiting flatironbootcampprep.com. In today's episode, I talk with Bridget Cromhow, a DevOps expert and principal cloud developer advocate at Microsoft. We talk about her background in technology, how she got into tech advocacy, her job at Microsoft, and how conferences and community involvement positively impacted her career. Bridget Cromhow is a DevOps professional who spent 15 years as an operations engineer and now works at Microsoft as a principal cloud developer advocate. She also leads the worldwide conference organization DevOps Days, runs community tech events in her home city of Minneapolis, co-hosts the Arrested DevOps podcast, and frequently participates in tech conferences as both a speaker and committee member. Hey, Bridget, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hi, Laurence. I'm really excited to be here. This is super fun.
Yeah, I'm really excited to chat with you about your wonderful experience in tech. You've done a bunch of different things, so I'm really excited to dive into that. First, though, is there anything that you would like to add to that intro before we jump into the other questions?
That's perfect. It's pretty much, you know, hashtag ops life and life after being on call.
Yes, and I would love to actually start talking about that. When you say life on call, could you describe what that means for the listeners and for me, actually, because I'm not 100% sure what that entails.
Okay, so my father's a physician. And sometimes we would be at, you know, the symphony, and he would leave his pager with the attendants, because it was, you know, the 80s or whatever, and they would come to his seat and get him, and he would have to go, I don't know, pull a piece of meat out of someone's throat in the middle of the night or whatever. And it's like, I remember thinking to myself as a kid, note to self, do not be a doctor. You get paged in the middle of the night and have to deal with things. Spoiler alert, I went into IT operations, which means I get paged in the middle of the night and have to deal with things. Only, at least they're not dying people, they're just broken computers.
Yes. So I know at my company, we use something called pager duty. And that's a similar, like when you say getting paged in the night, it could be maybe through a tool like that.
It's apps these days, PagerDuty, VictorOps, there's a number of services out there. It usually is an app and comes to your phone. No one carries actual pagers anymore. I remember I was actually on call for Y2K. I am old, and I was on call for Y2K, and I had an actual physical pager attached to the strap of my party dress. And I was dancing, and the strap broke, and I had to, like, hold the pager. I didn't get called that night, though, because we had actually fixed everything during the year before. Or in the lead up to the exciting night. It's no hype. Things would have actually gone much, much worse if we hadn't spent a bunch of time working on it. But I guess that's kind of the ops life thing, is you do a whole bunch of invisible work, and it's valued mostly in that no one notices it.
Yeah. And how did you get into IT operations? Was this something back in college that you knew you wanted to do?
Okay, so questionable life choices time. I've written a blog post about this because I've actually had somebody ask me how they could grow up to be me. And I was like, this is not a life path you're going to probably follow realistically. But I was a student worker at the university, trying to get a student job. I was a computer science major. And the first student job that I noticed that would be a good idea where I could get my homework done was in the lab. Like, they would have a room full of computers, you know, from like Sun and SGI and whatnot. And the students would come to do their homework. So I just got a job there because I figured I could do my homework while I sat there and got paid to give people their printouts. That was true. But I also ended up helping people with when the computers would have problems or when they couldn't figure out how to use them. And then I noticed that the people who worked in the basement and came upstairs and fixed the computers when they were broken and then went back downstairs had a lot more time to do their homework because they didn't have to sit at the desk. And so those were the student sysadmins. So I got one of those jobs the next year. And then I realized that the care and feeding of computers is something that is an entire job. Like, I was getting a CS degree and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it exactly. And even though this podcast is called Learn to Code with Me, like, I didn't at first end up doing a lot of coding. I ended up doing a lot more troubleshooting.
Okay, so you were back in university, you were studying computer science, and then you found the student job at the computer lab, and then you realized that the people who are actually fixing and sort of maintaining the computers seem to have more free time time to do homework.
This didn't turn out to actually be true, but I thought it would.
So you sort of switched and got into that, and that's really where it all began.
Yeah, and so it's kind of, and I have no idea if these exact jobs exist anymore. I assume some jobs, you know, I know some people who still work at universities helping with the care and feeding of the computers, but this was the 90s and many things seemed like a good idea at the time, including, school administrators giving the undergraduates who worked on the computers root. So like I had full administrator access on all the computer science faculty members' computers, which was great for learning. That could have gone wrong in so many ways, and it didn't, which is great, but yeah. I feel like I'm not sure that actually happens anymore, but
I feel like it honestly could at some universities. It wouldn't surprise me to be quite honest, but yeah, that's wild that you had all this access to like the faculty's computers. You probably were fixing faculty computers as well, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. So after college then, was your first position doing something similar then, but at, of course, a company?
Yeah. So I actually left college the first time without finishing because a friend of mine, it was, you know, 1999, and a friend of mine actually had the temerity to send an email to the computer science staff mailing list saying, poaching in our boss's name's employee pool. And three people actually did leave to go to full-time jobs instead of staying at their student jobs. This was at US West, which was what came before Quest, which is what came before CenturyLink. So it was a baby bell. It was a telco. And I worked in their internet division. So on things like email and news servers, Usenet used to be a thing. I mean, it's still a thing. I think people just don't use it quite so much anymore. But, you know, and authentication servers, a lot of stuff. Long story short, there was a great deal of ISP work, basically, that I was doing for this telco. So I did that for a few years. Then I worked at a small local ISP. Then I went back to the university. And somewhere along the way, I did actually finish my degree, but that was like a one class at a time sort of thing. Which is fine. I mean, people have this idea of like 4 years in and out, it's perfect and flawless. And it's like, sometimes you get a really good job opportunity and they pay for the rest of your classes and you just take one class at a time. And that worked fine. So, I mean, as long as you have the discipline to actually do the sparse linear matrices when you get home from work.
Yeah. So I'm really curious about that because I've spoken to guests on the show who have left college and at the time maybe didn't have plans for going back. They were studying computer science or something related. I also just know folks, in my day-to-day who maybe left school or got an internship there before their senior year and just never went back to school. So how did you find that motivation to go back to school? Because I feel like once you're out in the real world, like making like legitimate money, like from a full-time job, it can be, I'm just thinking, I mean, I finished school, of course, I studied history. So this was, you know, before I ever thought I'd get into technology. But I feel like even now, if I think about going to get a master's or something, I'm just like, oh, but imagine going to school and not making, you know, getting a paycheck and all this stuff.
Well, and that's why I took my last few classes. And I didn't have very many left, but I took my last few classes one class at a time at night. So I didn't have to go back to not having a paycheck because that was not going to happen.
Yes. Like, I feel like especially if you're in a tech career, whether you're a software engineer or doing what you were doing, and, you know, we all read the articles about how tech salaries and tech compensation, because it's, you know, these in-demand skills and not as many people have these skills tend to be higher. So it's especially in that case, I can't imagine. I guess when you're in your situation, you're doing the classes at night, which still takes a lot of motivation, even if you're taking one class at a time. Yeah. Wow. Were you going to an actual classroom or were you doing that? Like, I don't know what the right word, not remote.
Like online. I think one of them might have been remote, but yeah, the rest of them, I just went at night to an actual classroom. I don't necessarily recommend this. I'm just saying that it is definitely possible if you feel like you've lost the momentum of school and you're just working full time and you have those couple of classes where you would have a degree. I mean, for me, the trade-off was, yeah, it's a little bit of time, but once I have this degree, no one can take it away from me. And then you never know if you're going to later go to work at a place. Like I have a friend who, you know, left school without finishing and then later worked at a kind of annoying place that, you know, wanted them to have a degree. And it was like, oh, really? I mean, he didn't end up going back and getting one. He just ended up having to do some annoying paperwork to prove that they should give him this job at work. So it was like, it's tricky. If you can finish, even if it doesn't feel like you need the degree, it's nice to finish if you can.
Yeah. So. And I think especially, it sounds like you're really close to finishing anyway. You only had a few classes mm-hmm. left and it's, you know, it wasn't like after your freshman year. Right. So you were already so close to the finish line. And that's awesome though, that you were able to do that. And you mentioned, were the companies you were working for at the time were helping reimburse that?
Yeah. The company that I worked for while I was finishing it paid for it. So,
which is even better. Yeah.
And a lot of companies offer that sort of thing. Like they might not advertise it, but they do have it. And you might not look at it because you'll think education benefits. I don't have kids yet. And it's like, well, actually the education benefits could apply to you.
Yes. And I think that, I've experience working at smaller companies, but something that I found is, and just in many ways in life, I love this idea of you don't get what you don't ask for.
That's so true.
Yes. So I found that in my own experiences with things related to courses, maybe not going back to college, but some other kinds of courses or conferences or something related to professional development. Again, mm-hmm. as you said, even though it's not advertised, doesn't mean it's not possible and it doesn't hurt to ask.
It really doesn't, especially if and I had some of the classes met in the afternoon and I was like, oh, they're not going to let me take them because it'll interfere with work. But I was able to arrange it. So like those days I would come in earlier and, you know, finish up some stuff after the class. Like it's often a lot more flexible than you think it is. This is actually something that I see a lot is people think that there are more set in stone rules than there are. Like your organization probably has policies for a good reason, but they're probably also willing to work with you.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think that, again, you got to ask. If you don't ask, you never know what's possible. And usually, depends on what you're asking, but within reason, of course, there's definitely no harm in that. So I'm scrolling through your LinkedIn now, and I see that you used to work at Drama Fever.
I did.
And this is totally random. Sorry for the listeners if this is maybe not totally relevant. But I had someone on the show last season who happened to work at Drama Fever. He was a product manager. His name was Sam. Yes, Sam. I need to like verify that. If not, we'll have the editor take that out. But yeah, he worked there. And now I actually, at my full-time job, I work with someone who used to intern there, which to me is kind of crazy nice. Because I feel like is it a big company and I just am misinformed?
Well, when I worked there, I think there were about 100 people. I'm not positive how many are there now because they've actually been acquired by Warner Brothers. So it's like, obviously Warner Brothers is way bigger, but I'm not sure how many are still in the Drama Fever division. I think it's a little bit bigger. Maybe a couple hundred.
Yeah, but still.
I mean, I'm still friends with some of the people who work there, so.
Yeah, and Sam, you know what? Sam Gimble, he was on the show last, Drama Fever, product manager. That's actually, to me, kind of crazy. If I know, I know three people who worked at Drama Fever, if there was only 100, that's really high odds. It's really high.
It's probably the sort of thing that there are companies where you'll see a higher than usual representation of people from there, like either on podcasts or speaking at conferences, and you'll think like, wow, why does everyone from this company do that? And some of it can end up being like grouping behaviors. Like you'll get, if the company is pretty supportive of people going out and participating in things, then you may see people, you know, encourage their coworkers or they see that their coworkers do it. I mean, this is one of those like One of those things I think they don't really tell you about your career when you're starting to build it is that the stuff you do out in public life, whether it's a blog post for your company's blog, or it's speaking at a local meetup, or, you know, even fancier things, like those things are all part of your personal brand. They're all part of how you present yourself to the world. And while I was working at Drama Fever, I spoke at a bunch of conferences about Drama Fever technology. The next job I took after Drama Fever was a tech advocacy job where I was no longer on call, no longer the one operating the stuff. But the direct path to how I ended up in that job has to do with that extracurricular work that Drama Fever made space for me to do. So it's, I think it's great if your company is open to the idea of you participating in your wider community in whatever way, then you may stay there longer or you may not, but other people will hear about and want to work there because like the company encourages them to have a full and complete career.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And we were chatting a little bit about that before we hit the record button. I mentioned I want to talk more about being involved in the community and doing things outside your main, you know, job responsibilities. So at Drama Fever, I'm, again, looking back at the LinkedIn, you were an operations engineer, but as you mentioned, it sounds like you were really given the chance there to do more talks at meetups, perhaps write blog posts, kind of build your personal brand. And was that something they outwardly encouraged and tried to get all folks to do at the company? Or was that something that you had this, you know, own motivation on your own? You maybe asked or told them what you're up to and they were just totally supportive of that.
Yeah. I think it's going to vary from person to person at an org for sure. I had done a couple of conference things before I started at Drama Fever. And when I was pretty sure that I wanted to while working there, I think what was really helpful is my boss, who I've remained friends with over the years, Tim Gross, actually encouraged it and made sure that I had space in my schedule to work on, for example, if we had something cool we had put together and then I was going to give a presentation about it. Like we did a bunch of stuff with Docker in production really early. And then I spoke about it at OSCON, the O'Reilly Open Source Conference in 2015. And that's the kind of thing that if your boss isn't going to make time for you to do it, it can be really a struggle to work a full day and then also put a presentation together in your spare time. So I think that's the kind of thing where, even though they didn't necessarily have like a very specific like on-ramp to encourage people or whatever, they did do things like at their offices. I was remote, but at their offices in Philadelphia, they hosted like the local Golang meetup. And because we used a bunch of Go, that's the kind of thing that I feel like you're making time for your employees to work on their, you know, public facing materials, whether it's blog posts or presentations. And then also even like hosting meetups are things that companies can do that are really encouraging, even if they think, oh, we don't have time for a formal program. There are things they can do.
We're taking a quick break from this interview to hear a word from our sponsors, who help make the Learn to Code with Me podcast a reality. If you want to accelerate your tech skills in a higher education setting without student debt, check out Make School's Product College. As an aspiring software engineer, you'll receive one-on-one coaching, industry mentorship, and build projects with an amazing group of peers. You can take classes in web and mobile development, data science, machine learning, AI, entrepreneurship, product management, and design. Make School has 30 industry partners, including Facebook, LinkedIn, and Etsy, that look to hire directly from their diverse community. Their alumni work in engineering roles at Google, Facebook, and top Y Combinator-funded startups. And it's awesome to see a school align their incentives with their students' success. You only pay tuition once you've landed a job, and they even offer financial assistance for living expenses in San Francisco. What are you waiting for? Deadlines are approaching for their September 2018 start. So to be part of this incredible community in the heart of Silicon Valley, head over to makeschool.com to apply today. That's makeschool.com. Flatiron School's online web developer program, community-powered bootcamp, and free bootcamp prep courses are perfect for anyone interested in a career change and becoming a developer. Flatiron students come from a range of backgrounds, from financial to creative. What they all have in common is the passion, grit, and determination to learn to love code. Flatiron's rigorous 800-plus hour curriculum will teach you the skills you need to land a fulfilling career as a software engineer. Learn to Code with Me listeners can get an awesome $500 off their first month to get started on that career change. Just visit flatironbootcampprep.com. One online Flatiron student said he'd learned more in a couple of days with Flatiron than a year of computer science classes. If you're interested in learning how to think like a real developer while using tools actual developers use, check out Flatiron's online web developer program at flatironbootcampprep.com and claim your $500 discount. Yeah, and especially with the meetups. I mean, hosting a meetup at your office, if you have like the, you know, the right space and all that, can go such a long way. Also with hiring and recruiting, that's something I help out a bit with at my full-time job. And I write about hiring all the time and getting jobs in tech and so on and so forth. But it's such a great way to, yeah, provide value to the community and then give more people who maybe would never have the chance to get into your office and to, you know, check it out and to see what you guys are working on. And I also love the fact, kind of swooping back to what you were saying a bit earlier, how your boss would give you time to like work on conference presentations during, you know, your normal work hours. And I think that's really awesome and encouraging. And especially if you're going to the conference and, you know, on the slide deck, it has like your company name, like Drama Fever, even though sure, it's you giving the talk, but you're still promoting the company and just giving exposure. The word promote isn't good, but you're bringing exposure to Drama Fever that maybe they wouldn't have had in that environment otherwise.
Well, and plus then when people are thinking, do I want to take a job at this company? They can Google and see, oh, engineers who work at this company are talking about the cool thing they did over at that O'Reilly open source conference. Okay, this company sounds like a place for me. Like it's kind of these hidden benefits that the company doesn't necessarily see on a balance sheet, but then they see it's easier to hire. And back to the meetup topic too, I actually run the Minneapolis DevOps meetup and we have a meetup tonight actually. So this is an early start to today and then I'm running kind of late. Maybe I'll take a nap mid-afternoon. We have a local supply chain logistics company called SPS Commerce. And you would think to yourself, does that sound like a tech company? Well, they actually hire a lot of people to do tech things in town. And so they host the local meetups. And it's actually super funny because one person from SPS who shows up at the local meetup without fail every time is their recruiter. Because he knows perfectly well that the meetup is going to attract people who are possibly interested in, you know, jobs in the area and maybe don't have one or maybe have one that they want to switch out of. And so it's a big win for a company to be the place that's hosting local meetups just because, you like you said, you get people in, you get them seeing your office, but you also get them seeing that you as an organization are putting your money where your mouth is. Or putting your money where other people's mouths are because, you know, they often buy the delicious meetup snacks.
Yes, 1,000%. And so you were doing these and you still do these conferences and a lot of community involvement through your full-time job and still through your full-time work today. But of course, you have other projects outside of that, right? Like the Arrested DevOps podcast. And I'm sure there's other, like the meetup that you just mentioned that you run in Minneapolis that I'm guessing isn't really tied into your full-time job today. So when did that other kind of of course it's professional related, but not specific to the full-time job kind of side projects start to pop up?
Yeah. So I probably go back a couple of jobs to like the one before Drama Fever. I was working at a social commerce startup in Minneapolis. Fun fact, by the way, Jamie Thingelstad, the CTO there, is now the CTO at SPS Commerce, which is a much bigger company. It's like, oh, I worked with him at a tiny company. And, you know, now I'm helping him hire people at his big company. But he encouraged me to speak at a local bar camp, like it was kind of an unconference. And after I did that and then attended and spoke at a couple of other smaller conferences, including DevOps Days, which are, you know, community conferences that are in a variety of cities around the world. Somebody from Chef, Michael Ducey, encouraged me to run a Minneapolis DevOps Days. So I did that in 2014. And then in early 2015, I actually joined the Global Core Committee of DevOps Days organizers as the head organizer. And so being involved with a a global community of people, all of which, you know, all of whom I'm connected with. Like, I see some of them at conferences sometimes, but I'm also on Twitter with them all the time. And getting cross-pollination of ideas between cities and between countries, of people coming and talking about the things they're working on. I think that getting involved with that was really great, because I speak at conferences myself, but I also, I really appreciate having a chance to lift up the voices of other people, especially people who might not be heard from in tech all the time. And it could be because they are an underrepresented minority in tech. It could be because they are just spending all of their time writing code and didn't realize that people would really love to hear from them. So I think that, like, getting involved with a wider community of people who help make that possible showed me that there was stuff I could do that was not specifically tied to my employer. And in fact, I've continued doing this stuff through several different employers. But it also, the surprise, I think I knew I would be able to keep doing it. The surprise for me was I didn't realize I would end up with a job that was kind of hitting squarely in this area. Like, that came as kind of a surprise.
Yeah, and you just led me right into the next question I wanted to ask, which is amazing. I would love if you could talk a bit about what you do today at Microsoft. And then I'm also looking at what you're doing at Pivotal Software. And it sounds like you were kind of in this similar mm-hmm. advocacy kind of role. So yeah, how did this community involvement turn into these sorts of roles at other software companies?
Yeah, so I was never planning on not being an operations engineer. Like, I enjoy solving production problems and scaling systems. Like, that's stuff I really like. But when I was changing jobs most recently by one, before this change to Microsoft. But when I was changing jobs most recently, I was talking with a friend of mine from the DevOps Days community who I know on Twitter and conferences, Andrew Clay Schaefer. And he made a very compelling argument that instead of being on call for my own production systems, I could help a lot of people at a lot of organizations scale up their systems. And I like the idea of having a pretty big impact if I can. You know, I'm going to have the widest impact I can. And he made a pretty compelling argument that it's something I should at least try. So the difference with tech advocacy is you don't necessarily get the super fun, long-term, build something and watch it grow and then troubleshoot it and fix it and iterate on it, because that's not your role. But you do get a pretty firm foundation in the technology of the company that you're advocating for. And then you get, this is the really fun part that I wasn't expecting, is you go into all of these, you know, organizations, whether they be, you know, banks or car companies or government agencies, and they all are looking to you to help them figure out what they should do, which I'm like, oh, wow, that's a boatload of responsibility you're putting on me. But it also is, it's enheartening to realize that, I got to say, when I was on the other side of the table, I always kind of assumed vendors were trying to sell me a bill of goods, and I wasn't necessarily very trusting of them. But if you can find vendors to work with who do have your best interests in heart, who will tell you if a solution is not necessarily going to solve your problem, like the good vendors, the ones that you can trust to not ruin everything for you just to make their quotas, which is to say, the people who work at a vendor who maybe are not on a comp plan, who don't have a sales quota to make and are just there to help you with the vendor's products, they can be really, really helpful to you. So it was kind of exciting to get into a position where I got to see how the sausage was made inside a lot of organizations and hopefully, I think, help them make choices that would set them on a path to everything being a lot more sustainable and repeatable, and their on-call people would not get paged in the night.
Got it. So you spoke already a little bit about this, but I'm curious, what does your day-to-day look like? And I know you mentioned you started your new role at Microsoft quite recently, so maybe you just want to talk about what you were doing at Pivotal. However, it sounds like you aren't, you know, writing code, you're not maintaining systems, you're not doing the sorts of things that you were doing in your previous position as an actual operations engineer. And instead, you're out in the community more, you're working with vendors, and it sounds like you're maybe doing a lot of travel.
This is that's the dark secret behind any kind of DevRel or advocacy, or some people call it evangelism. Though to me, that sounds like you're knocking on the door and asking people if they've heard the good news about Microsoft. Like, I'm not going to call myself an evangelist because that's just ridiculous. But for the dark secret is, yes, you really probably, if you take a role like this, are going to do a non-zero amount of travel. I think Schaefer, when I started at Pivotal, he said it would be around 30%. I ended up self-inflicting a lot more travel than that on myself, but I did actually have to figure it out in 2016 for tax purposes. Some months I was home 50%, and some months I was home about 15%. I was on the road about 85%. So that is something to consider. Like, this might not be... I don't think, you know, DevRel tech advocacy is the kind of job you jump into first right out of school anyway, just because you probably need to have a bunch of, I don't know, scar tissue of your own before you can go talk to people about theirs. But you probably wouldn't want to do this if you had a lot of responsibilities that made it difficult to travel. Like, my garden would get neglected quite a bit, and my spouse would... you know, be on FaceTime with me quite a bit. As it turns out, cats are not interested in talking to you on video chat. Pro tip. Like, you're talking to them and they're like, no, not interested. So that is something to, you know, be warned about.
Yeah, but I think, you know, if some people want that in a career, or they would love the opportunity to travel. In fact, totally unrelated, but my father, who's now in his 60s and he's worked in tech his entire life, he travels less now, but my entire childhood, his entire career, he always was traveling a lot, not doing the advocacy thing, but working with different clients across the country and even internationally. So mm-hmm. I think, yeah, again, it's just something that, as you mentioned, to keep in mind for folks that, you know, don't want to be on the go all the time. And as you said too, yeah, it sounds like it's definitely something for people, as you put, have the scar tissue first and have the industry experience, and they're really familiar with the issues, and that, you know, totally makes sense why it would be a better fit for someone who's kind of been there, done that. So it's really exciting that you are now at Microsoft, and I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty, but I kind of want to. What because your title is, looking again at the LinkedIn, Principal Cloud Developer Advocate. So cloud developer, principal cloud developer, then advocate. Okay, I understand the advocate part.
And are principal clouds different than the other clouds? I know, right?
Yeah, so could you, you know, you don't need to go into like a long-winded thing, but kind of, are you working on a certain product, or how does that work? Yeah.
Yeah, and back to, I sort of got sidetracked on the travel and didn't completely answer your other question either, which is, what does this kind of job look like day to day? And I mean, the answer is you're looking at it or listening to it, as the case may be. I do a bunch of podcasting and run meetups. Last week, all the weeks are running together in my head, I was at Velocity in New York. No, week before last, I was at a conference out in New York, and running a track, and some of my coworkers were speaking at it. Jesse Frizzell, one of my coworkers at Microsoft, was keynoting at Velocity. Brendan Burns, who works on the Kubernetes project, was also speaking at this conference, and Michelle Nurali, who works on Helm. Next week, I'm getting on a plane on Sunday, and I'm speaking at the All Things Open conference in Raleigh on Monday, and then I'm flying to Philadelphia, and I'm speaking at DevOps Days Philadelphia on Wednesday, I want to say. So I should probably finish those talks. So like, what this week looks like is I'm working on two different conference talks, one of which I've given several times and one of which is new. But anyway, back to your question about how is this like Microsoft specific? The focus of my role at Microsoft is on Azure, and one of the exciting things is that I learned how to pronounce Azure, because for some reason I always thought it was pronounced Azure, but I guess that's more of a European pronunciation. I don't know, but it's because Microsoft, you know, spoiler alert, has a cloud, and a lot of people think that cloud is synonymous with, say, Amazon. I think both Google and Microsoft make sure to have people out there who can talk about the features and facets of their cloud and, you know, just kind of think about use cases. So we have a lot of exciting stuff that's just now, you know, changing and growing with like Azure container instances and like different ways that people can bring containerized workloads or containerize their workloads and then bring them to our cloud. So in between working on the couple of talks I had previously lined up before I started this job, I previously lined up for next week. One of the things that is kind of on my stretch goals that I really need to do in the next month or so is spend enough time getting familiarizing myself with, say, because my specific role is around Linux and containers, familiarizing myself with like the Azure container stuff. So some of that I've already been through, and some of my other new coworkers, because we're kind of a new team, have already been through like updating some of the documentation about how it actually works and making sure that the documentation is relevant to the communities that we're already members of. And so this is all stuff that I hope that, this time next year, I'll be able to tell you I'm an expert in. And the exciting thing about this job, and one of the reasons I took this job, is that I'm not. So like, I think that's another thing is like, if you feel 100% comfortable and confident with every facet of your job, and you know the conversations you're going to have next week are totally in the bag because you've had those conversations last week, like, that's probably a good time to be looking at stretching yourself. Like, I went to, go work for Microsoft on Linux and containers. And by the way, they issued me a Mac. So it's like, it's a whole new Microsoft. But I went to go, do this completely different thing because I knew I could learn and grow. Not because it was easy.
I love that. And I think that's actually such a great way to just end this interview on talking about, stretching yourself and how you took this new role at Microsoft and you're continuing to learn and to grow, even though, I mean, you've been the tech game, the industry for 15 mm-hmm. plus years, but you're continuing to learn new things and do new things and explore your career further. And I think that's amazing. And also, I think you mentioned this earlier in the interview, or maybe it was before we hopped on the call, about how someone asked you how they become you. And I think you have such a cool job. I mean, that sounds like amazing. Obviously, you worked super hard to get to where you are today, but I think it's something that a lot of people can kind of put as a vision of theirs, right? Like, to work in the industry for X plus years and then to get a job like being advocate of these technologies and just having that larger impact, not just impacting your company, but impacting like other companies that may use the product, people that work in the field. It's just, it's amazing what you're doing. And like, I'm sure like you're like literally impacting thousands of people's lives and their jobs.
I hope so. I mean, I want to impact a lot of people and help them have better IT experiences, because everything we do at work, we take home with us and we're grumbling about it or we're smiling about it. And I think that those of us who can make the world around us better should try.
Awesome. Thank you so much again, Bridget, for coming on the show. And where can people find you online?
So I am on Twitter as Bridget Crumhout. The spelling is probably in the show notes or, on the site or in your podcast app or whatever. And I do, fun fact, have a Google unique name. So all of the Bridget Crumhout that you find on the internet is me. And I blog occasionally at bridgetcrumhout.com, but I'd say Twitter is probably the easiest place. And I'm going to be at a few conferences this year, but if you want to talk to people with ideas about, this stuff, the DevOps Days conferences, if you look at devopsdays.org, I think we're in 51 cities on 6 continents in 2017. So there may be one coming this fall to a city near you.
Wow. Awesome. Thank you again for coming on.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks for tuning in. For a recap or to browse through other episodes and show notes, head on over to learntocodewith.me/podcast. If you like tech-related content like this podcast, make sure to sign up for my email list. You can do so easily right on the homepage at learntocodewith.me. There's a big sign-up form right at the top. I'll send you new blog posts, tell you about time-limited course deals, and much more. It was great to have you with me today. Join me next week for another episode.